Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kunnison with Noel Lim and Lynn Mark in the studio this morning. Let's talk about the urban poor.
Because it's been more than a year since the first MCO, and 71% of the poorest urban households say they still need financial aid in the coming months. This is according to the fourth and final installment of the Families on the Edge report produced by UNICEF in partnership with the UN Population Fund and DM Analytics. Now, cash transfers remain a necessary aid to the B40 group for their survival, and the study found that 60% still could not buy enough food for their families.
Worryingly, the study also revealed that more than a third of Project Perumahan Rakyat PPR folks remain unwilling to inoculate despite the vaccine being provided free by the government. So diving into the study's findings, we have with us Stephen Barrett, Chief of Social Policy at UNICEF Malaysia. Stephen, a very good morning to you. Your February survey has indicated that the median household income among participant families had recovered to 95% of the pre-crisis level. But how will the latest round of the MCO affect these families?
But you're quite right. We were delighted to see that median incomes had recovered to near pre-COVID levels for the sample as a whole. I think one caveat to that is, well, two caveats to that. One is that the levels were lower amongst female-headed households and households affected, you know, headed by people with disabilities, significantly lower. And of course, they've recovered to a level which was already a low level of income. You know, so even a 5% average deficit compared to 2019, that matters a lot in low-income families. In terms of, you know, what impact the new MCO will have, I hope that it doesn't have the depth of impact that earlier MCOs had. You know, there's more economic activity which is allowed this time round. But that said, you know, it's always the most vulnerable, the informal sector workers that lose their jobs and lose their incomes first in these situations. So it's a little bit unpredictable. I think we also have to remember that even though economic activities are allowed in lots of places, there's the impact of school closures to consider. And you know, you've now got children who would normally be in school and are back at home needing to be cared for, and that will certainly impact on the labour market activities and income earning potential of these households.
So your survey also showed an increase in direct social assistance from the government, as well as the families using their savings to mitigate any reduction of income. But realistically, how long can this go on? Are there any interventions that can be done?
The study has shown consistently that the income support that has been provided by government has been critical. But those key programs, the BPR in particular, has now expired. And we don't know what the situation is going to be, you know, for MCO3 and beyond. So in terms of interventions that are needed, I would defer to what the families said themselves. You know, 70% of the respondents said that they needed regular and reliable income support. And the most popular policy proposal, because, you know, we asked them, we presented a range of policy options and we asked them which they felt was most relevant to their needs. And the most popular policy proposal was monthly allowances for children, people with disabilities and older people in low income households. So I think, you know, what these families are saying is that they, you know, yes, the support that's been provided has been critical, but there's a need for regularity and reliability. You know, we're all struggling with the uncertainty of this situation. And what was a short-term crisis, what we thought was going to be a short-term crisis, is now turning into a very long-term crisis. And we need to inject some security and predictability into the lives of low-income families. I think other things that could be done, you know, we've got children that are no longer in school, children from low-income families who would have been eligible for free school meals and no longer getting those free school meals. I think alternative provision needs to be put in place for children from those families.
Well, average wage is still very low, between 1,200 and 1,300 ringgit. What more can we do for the poor?
Certainly, there are skills issues. I mean, in lower income families, of course, lower income workers tend to be have lower levels of education and skills. But I, you know, I think there's some other issues as well. And if we look at these families, you will see limitations on their capacity for labour market engagement. If you look at the burden of care for children, for the elderly, people with disabilities in these households, it's higher in higher income families. You see a higher proportion of single parents whose labour market activities are constrained by the need to care for children. And then you also have the impact of mental health on productivity. This is often not understood. the other thing about, you know, being trapped, incomes are not static. You know, we often talk about the poor as if they're a group of people that can be easily identified. The fact is that people living in poverty change all the time, and we need to provide security, a platform of economic security, so people can work their way out of poverty. But they do need that foundation level support. The Families on the Edge study has shown that considerable ingenuity, diversification of people's income sources, people moving into self-employment and that lost their jobs, you know, that's there. So it's not that people are not trying, but what we know from the international evidence on escaping poverty is that people need sustained support for their escape from poverty to be sustainable. And often that realistically means it's an intergenerational process. So we need to invest in the children in low-income families to ensure that they can do better than their parents.
Stephen, on another note here, the survey also pointed towards high levels of COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy, with only 6 in 10 surveyed willing to take the vaccine. Why is this number so high?
So yeah, this was an interesting finding and obviously very concerning. The data tells us that the primary reasons for the sort of hesitancy were concerns around side effects of the vaccine and safety. So, you know, the question is, why are we seeing these rates higher amongst lower income families than elsewhere? I mean, it's important to note that vaccine hesitancy appears to be higher among marginalized communities in many countries, not just in Malaysia. So you've got lower levels of education, meaning lower understanding of the level of the risks, even inability maybe to, you know, or lower ability to understand some of the scientific, quite a complex scientific data which is being presented on these issues. And there's also susceptibility to misinformation. I think we've also got to consider the fact that, you know, low-income families have a lower tolerance for risk due to the lower levels of protection that they have, be it from public or private means.
So then what can be done to encourage vaccination amongst this group?
I think the first thing to do is recognise the primary causes. I think there was, going into this, there may have been some assumptions that concerns around the halal status of vaccines may have been an impediment to people taking the vaccine. And FOE shows that that wasn't the case. That is not the primary concern. People's concerns are safety and side effects. So I think, you know, improving transparency on the data on those issues. We need to have probably targeted communications to low-income groups using channels that they have access to, and crafting messages and information in ways that they can easily digest. And then I think, you know, you'll see headway being made on some of those that hesitancy.
So has the government indicated any changes in policies or future planning to address the issues highlighted in your recent report?
I think it's important to recognise that, you know, from our perspective, the government's been very receptive to the Families on the Edge study. We've had multiple meetings with multiple ministers over the course of the past year. And, you know, Families on the Edge has featured very heavily during the discussions on the design of the various stimulus packages and also the 2021 budget. We did see some improvements. You know, if we look at the BSH programme, we saw increases in the value of transfers for families with children, lower income families with children. And then the 2021 budget included a really important commitment to extending social welfare support to all 400,000 households living in poverty. But of course, you know, that 400,000 was a pre-COVID number. We know that many more are likely to be eligible now. And we're still some way off from having a social protection system that actually responds in a timely manner to changes in household circumstances. We still have quite a static understanding of poverty in terms of policy design. I would say that, you know, we are there is probably a need to provide more sustained support. You know, we are still maybe in the realms of short-term responses to the crises as they emerge. You know, you know, we need to recognise that recovery from COVID-19 is going to take some time.
Stephen, thank you so much for your time. That was Stephen Barrett, Chief of Social Policy at UNICEF Malaysia, giving us a lay of the land of the fourth and final installment of the Families on the Edge report, and this time including some vaccine hesitancy stats there. 4 in 10 were vaccine hesitant, which is a concerning number, 40%.
Yeah, so I think, you know, all of this is tied to around income, right? So if the government has acknowledged that the poverty line income is now about 2,200 ringgit, should we now look into raising a minimum wage level, right? But that alone is not enough to solve poverty because a large percentage of B40 people rely on irregular income. And as a result of that, they may have to rely on personal loans for emergencies, or they're not able to take up house loans to acquire assets, right? And it's very hard for them to build wealth. And that's why poverty becomes an intergenerational issue unless there's some drastic intervention.
BFM 89.9.